Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 12, 2017. Lots in the news today. My headline is Trump on Puerto Rico and Obamacare drop dead. Yeah, I'm thinking of that famous headline from the New York tabloid back in the 1970s. And Trump is letting Puerto Rico know that he doesn't have much patience for the lazy bastards on that island. Excuse my language, but it's infuriating that he has used Twitter to attack the mayor of San Juan because she had the temerity to demand an adequate response to the devastating hurricane and the needs of people in San Juan and across the island of Puerto Rico. And Trump is making it clear that Houston and Florida, solid red states that supported him in 2016, they're going to get everything they need for as long as they need it. But Puerto Rico, that is the debtor nation that brought on this hurricane all by itself. And Trump is blaming the victims in more ways than one. It's really ugly. And as we battle the out-of-control wildfires here north of San Francisco, I have increased empathy and increased outrage at the treatment of the people of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. And I've been to those islands, Puerto Rico, St. John, St. Thomas, St. Croix. I've sailed around them. And I can't believe that Trump is just ready to write them off. You're on your own. He tweeted today that Puerto Rico can't expect the feds to stay forever. But if you ask the experts, after Hurricane Katrina or any other major disaster, FEMA and the federal support services stay in place for years. It's only been 3 weeks since Maria devastated Puerto Rico, and Trump is already out of patience. He started, in the days after the disaster, lecturing the Puerto Ricans on their debtor status. They are victims of vulture capitalists. And yes, they use those Goldman Sachs techniques to sell tax-free bonds, and they rolled up a lot of debt. Now that debt is owned by a handful of white Americans, most of whom live in wealthy conditions in New York City. And Trump's more concerned about the vulture bondholders than he is about people who are trapped in towns that have yet to receive fresh water, food supplies. And the amount of people on Puerto Rico receiving electricity actually fell by 6%, back to 90%. 90% of the public in Puerto Rico can't really understand what Trump is saying because they don't have electricity to power a TV set or even a radio. Cell phone service has returned to some extent. And we'll recap the situation there in a moment. But this is bizarre. Cheryl Atkison used to work for CBS News, and while I support her claims that she was illegally subject to surveillance by probable federal agents, Cheryl Atkison now works for Sinclair, the right-wing network that controls all of these local television stations and feeds them right-wing propaganda that the local stations must run on a daily basis. And I give credit to the Public Television News Hour, which joined John Oliver in exposing what Sinclair is up to and how the FCC is greasing the way for Sinclair to expand its ownership by buying up the Tribune TV stations. And it was fascinating to see PBS use a clip from a comedy show, the John Oliver HBO Sunday Night Show, where they edited together clips of news anchors in various cities on stations owned by Sinclair who were reading from the exact same script. That's how controlled all this is. So Cheryl Atkison now works for Sinclair, and Trump cited her in a tweet. Puerto Rico survived the hurricanes. Now a financial crisis looms largely of their own making, says Cheryl Atkison. And so Trump quoted that and then relayed it to his slavish followers. And then he continued, a total lack of accountability, say the governor. Electric and all infrastructure was disaster before hurricanes. Congress to decide how much to spend. We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders, who have been amazing under the most difficult circumstances, in Puerto Rico forever. And last night, Rachel Maddow showed that the hospital ship that was delayed in being dispatched to Puerto Rico is now there, and they've treated exactly 7 patients. They have massive facilities on this ship, and it could be very different. And I have a hard time blaming the Puerto Ricans for their failure to participate in these recovery efforts. That is bullshit. And they are now looking at a cash flow problem. Puerto Rico may run out of money by the end of this month, and Trump asked Congress to give them a payday loan. Yeah, not a grant, not a gift, not, hey, you know, you guys need help, this is what we're going to give you. A $4.9 billion loan. And this is just adding insult to the obvious injury. And so here's a quote from a Bush administration Homeland Security guy, James Norton. He said, it's fairly typical for FEMA, DHS, and other executive agencies to be on the ground running recovery operations for years to come. I would expect them to be operating in Texas and Florida for the next couple of years. But Puerto Rico? You are a U.S. possession. But you don't have a voting member of Congress. And you are obviously a stepchild, a bastard, in the feral mind of Donald Trump. And a New York City councilman who's Puerto Rican said, somehow we're a burden and we're mooching. That's the kind of language this president is throwing around. So, as I mentioned, 90% of Puerto Rico is without electricity. A couple of days ago, it had been reduced to 86%, but then they had problems with what they call grid instability. The governor, who kisses Trump's ass, says that he hopes 25% of the island will have power restored by the end of October. That's more than 2 weeks away. And you're telling me the Corps of Engineers couldn't run cables and put in some sort of an emergency power grid to distribute electricity during this crisis? They can't install generators at, you know, certain points around the island to at least provide fundamental electrical service? Now, the only bright spot is that 64% of the population, we're told, now has cellular phone services. But the same number, 64% of the population, still lacks access to clean drinking water. And this could lead to an outbreak of cholera. Like in Yemen, there are more than 1 million people fighting cholera there today. And it is unacceptable that we treat Puerto Rico like some abandoned third world nation. I as you can tell, it really infuriates me. Now to Obamacare. Today, Trump staged a signing event at the White House. A bunch of Republicans, including some women, hovered over him and applauded as he announced that he is signing an executive order that will clear the way for crappy insurance to be made available to many Americans. And it's another case of where Trump is kind of loose and a loose cannon, I guess. Anyway, he shook hands with all these people in the room, and then he started to exit before Mike Pence grabbed him and said, hey, Don, you're supposed to sign this thing, remember? And so he sat down and he signed it. With these actions, he said, we are moving toward lower costs and more options in the health care market and taking crucial steps toward saving the American people from the nightmare of Obamacare. And we're going to save them by offering substandard coverage. It will cost less. But just try to use it. Just hope you don't get sick if you're using one of these Trump care policies. And then the hyperbole that he is just compulsive about. This is going to be something that millions and millions of people will be signing up for, and they're going to be very happy. This will be great health care. Now, he knows that's a lie. But he's a salesman, and he believes that he can craft your reality around his bullshit. Now, in reality, he is directing three cabinet agencies to develop rules that would expand access to less expensive, less comprehensive insurance, including policies that could be sold by trade associations and short-term medical coverage that could be offered by commercial insurers to individuals and families. But this is just one step in the concerted effort to cripple and kill Obamacare. And the New York Times published a listicle today. I guess they're catching up with BuzzFeed and the Huffington Post. Trump care is undermining Obamacare. Here are 11 ways. One, the announcement today opening the door for sales of less expensive plans with fewer benefits and fewer protections. Second, deciding not to send health department officials to local open enrollment events related to Obamacare. Shutting down the Affordable Care Act website for 12 hours nearly every Sunday. I wasn't aware of that. They're cutting funding by 40% to the groups, typically nonprofits, that help people work through the complicated effort to enroll. And I just renewed my Obamacare yesterday. Took about 30 minutes online. It was a little convoluted. The website had a few glitches, but I believe I have renewed with a mere 5.8% increase for 2018. Trump has also slashed spending on advertising and promotion by 90%. He's made videos criticizing the health care law and posted them on YouTube. He has posted infographics on Twitter criticizing the Obamacare law. He's made tax credits for premiums less generous. He's used news releases to spread negative information about the law, weakened enforcement of the individual mandate, and removed useful guidelines for consumers from the website. And that occurred on January 20th. That was one of the first steps that the administration took. Today, I'm releasing a very interesting, in-depth interview with reporter Trevor Aronson, who writes for The Intercept. And his latest piece really captures the rogue agency, the FBI, as they attempt to intimidate and use extortion against a 37-year-old man from Tampa, Florida, who has fought back. This guy is courageous. His name is Jabbar Ali Rafai. And despite the fact that he's got multiple sclerosis, he has taken on the effort to intimidate him, to press what appear to be false charges against him in order to get him to become a federal informant. And the bizarre process was captured on recordings and video surveillance that Rafai installed at his home. When he talked to FBI agents, he insisted on recording their conversations, and they allowed him to do it. And so he has a record of a 2-year harassment scene. They put GPS devices on his car, his girlfriend's car. They managed, he says, to put some kinds of surveillance devices in the electrical outlets in his home. That was before they actually raided the home and made his pregnant girlfriend crawl on the driveway. As she voluntarily left her home, they had busted down the door without bothering to knock and see if she would answer first. And these tactics were used behind what were really vague allegations that he had some sympathies for the Islamic State and charges that he was trafficking in stolen or unauthorized auto parts in a side business that he ran on eBay. Here's Trevor Aronson talking about how Rafai confronted the FBI agent and said, "This is extortion."
Yeah, that's why I thought it was like such a great quote, because he's like, "No, that's called extortion," meaning like, yeah, this is painfully clear that this is extortion, right? I mean, a lawyer might quibble, like, is it extortion, is it not? At the very least, it's strong-arming, right? Like, you're basically saying, you know, unless you work with us on this, work with us and cooperate with us, you're going to, you know, the boot heel of the government is going to come down on you in federal court. And that seemed to be directly the implication. And, you know, and ultimately, and unfortunately for Rafai, that's exactly what happened, right? In April, unbeknownst to Rafai, he'd actually been indicted by a grand jury for tax evasion or filing a false tax return, alleging that in 2010, you know, he did not report his eBay income, the amount of which is not specified, right?
I invite you to listen to the full interview with reporter Trevor Aronson. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And those great subscribers include Billy Cook in Eureka, his mom, Susan Lewis, who just took out a, maybe it's Luis, just took out a an annual subscription for Billy's stepdad, who is a recovering conservative. I love it. I also want to mention some other great people like Faith Peoples and Jason Spitzer, Sandra Fish. They're all regular supporters of the Peter B. Collins podcast, and that's what makes all this work. Now, I don't make a boatload of money doing this, maybe about 10 bucks an hour. But I do have expenses with the web hosting and all that sort of stuff. And your contributions via these subscriptions are what make it all happen. So come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. And at the sign-up page, you can make a choice that fits your budget and the level of support you'd like to offer. There's another great piece at The Intercept, published just yesterday. Sean King was working for a New York tabloid as a columnist, and he jumped to The Intercept recently. And he exposes a story that I have seen absolutely nowhere in my daily scans of the corporate media. And, in all probability, you're not aware of this event that occurred on October the 6th at the Asheville Regional Airport in North Carolina. Video surveillance showed a man walking through the front doors in black clothing, a black cap, while carrying a bag. When he left the terminal moments later, he left without the bag. So they brought in a bomb-sniffing dog, and the dog was aroused by the contents of the bag. When they opened it, they found ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives, along with shrapnel and bullets. Now, this is one of those lone wolf incidents, at least based on the sketchy reporting that we have so far. And maybe it didn't make the news because the suspect was quite open. That, yeah, I was trying to, here's the quote, preparing to fight a war on U.S. soil, and this bomb was part of that war. And Sean King speculates that the reason we've heard diddly about this is that the suspect, who's now in custody, is a white man named Michael Christopher Estes. And we don't have footage of the FBI, you know, just thumping their chests and saying, look how we protected you from another terrorist event. And this one appears to be real. We're not aware of a paid FBI informant who set this guy up. But the lack of coverage is puzzling. I really don't understand it. There is more challenge in the mainstream media about yesterday's shift in the timeline of events related to the mass shooting in Las Vegas. And this is really interesting because I'm citing first an Associated Press article. A day after authorities revised the timeline of events on the night of the Las Vegas shooting, the hotel where the gunman was staying is casting doubt on the changes. So police shifted the timeline. They said on Tuesday, I think, that Stephen Paddock shot a hotel security guard through the door of his high-rise hotel suite 6 minutes before he began shooting at the crowd at the country music festival across the street. Now, this raises more questions than it answers, because if he shot the guard first and then he went on this 10-minute automatic weapons shooting spree, why didn't the guard radio in and say, look, I've been shot? And we really can't understand how that would have occurred and why they would change the narrative at this point. But in a careful statement issued by the hotel, the Mandalay Bay, which is owned by MGM Resorts, we cannot be certain about the most recent timeline. We believe what is currently being expressed may not be accurate. And the AP story ends with this: the revised timeline raises questions about whether better communications could have allowed officers to respond more quickly and take out the gunman before the attack. It remains unclear whether police ever received a call for help from the injured guard. So I want to share with you one of my resources where I go looking for the alternative facts, as Kellyanne would say. And it's a website called Citizens for Legitimate Government. It was started by a professor at NYU, Michael Rechtenwald, and it's run by a woman named Lori Price, who I've talked with a few times. And sometimes they go a little too far for me. And so I want to share this with you, and I'm just going to read some of the headlines. And I've put the link to Citizens for Legitimate Government's webpage in my show file for today's podcast. I encourage you to go and look at this and be open-minded. And don't believe everything you see here. I don't. But many questions are raised about the narrative that we have been fed. And there's an interesting angle here that is reported today, that the CEO of MGM Resorts International, as I mentioned, the owners of the Mandalay Bay Hotel Complex, James Murren, first engaged in a big stock buyback. That generally raises the value of the existing shares. Then he divested 80% of the shares he owned in his own company. And this was all in September. He did it in time to collect dividends. And then he sold those shares. I think he's got some explaining to do. And they also assert here that George Soros, the billionaire investor, bought $42 million worth of puts. A put is betting that a stock price is going to go down. And that's based on SEC filings from mid-August. All right, on to other details. Hotel worker reported shooting before Las Vegas massacre started. 2 days after police revised their timeline, a hotel maintenance worker said he told hotel dispatchers to call the police before the mass shooting started. Another story, Las Vegas gunman shot security guard a full 6 minutes. That's the shift in the timeline. And the last element here says, but Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo said that Paddock shot Campos before his mass shooting, and they don't know why he stopped his attack on the crowd. Another item, a Facebook user and reported eyewitness Gio Rios says there was more than one shooter. I believe there were 4 to 5 shooters. I saw or heard 4 of them. There was one of their men down in the concert who lit firecrackers either to distract people or to decoy the Mandalay Bay shooter breaking the windows out of the hotel. Ah, there's more. An Australian man who was staying in the room next to Paddock, in room 32134, says there were multiple people dead and multiple shooters. I was just hiding, waiting for police to come get us. I got outside safely and was hiding in bushes. Then there is a separate report that Stephen Paddock ordered room service on September 27th for 2 people. We don't know who his dinner companion might have been. So I share this with you. I can't prove any of these individual elements or allegations. But taken as a whole, there are a lot of problems with the narrative that we have been fed about the massacre in Las Vegas. And if you have information from sources that you think are worth considering, feel free to share it with me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Well, the struggle between Madrid and Barcelona continues. The president of Catalonia has accused the Spanish government of ignoring his calls for negotiations after it laid down an ultimatum yesterday, and we reported on this. The prime minister in Madrid, Mariano Rajoy, has asked the president of Catalonia, whose name is Carles Puigdemont, whether or not the independence has been declared. He gave him 8 days to drop his independence plans and return Catalonia to constitutional order. And if he fails, The Madrid government will use Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution, which permits the imposition of direct rule on an autonomous region like Catalonia. Puigdemont tweeted out, "We asked for dialogue, and the response is to put Article 155 on the table. Message understood." And his vice president tweeted, "A sincere dialogue is what the international community wants and what Catalonia expects, not confrontation and new threats." So it's a real standoff. And my concern is that Madrid will send in troops and will have a true Spanish Civil War 2.0. I'm a little bit uneasy about this, but I'm reporting this in general as good news. The Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, signed a reconciliation deal in Cairo today that aims to end their decade-old rivalry by providing for a joint administration with control of Gaza's borders, including the Rafah crossing into Egypt. Now, the reason I'm uneasy is this was brokered by Egyptian intelligence. And Egypt is an ally of Israel in some respects, not in every respect. Also, we're told that the Saudis are supporting this effort, and they have formed a recent alliance with Israel in some respects that gives me the creeps. So, the deal Fatah will lift their sanctions on Gaza. Hamas officials will allow the Palestinian Authority to resume control in Gaza. A government of national accord will go into effect by December 1st. If all goes well, the Palestinian Authority president might visit Gaza in the next month or so, the first time in 10 years. So I generally consider this good news because the Israeli effort to divide the Palestinians has been very effective over the last 10 years. But I also think because Hamas has some 25,000 armed fighters, that this will be used as a pretext by Netanyahu to claim that they are all terrorists and to refuse any further negotiations or moves toward peace as they continue to provoke with more illegal settlement activity, particularly in the West Bank. And the U.S. has joined Israel in pulling out of UNESCO. UNESCO is the cultural division of the United Nations. We've pulled out before. And while we say the U.S. and Israel are saying that there's anti-Israel bias, most recently expressed in July when UNESCO infuriated Israeli officials by designating the ancient city of Hebron in the West Bank as a World Heritage Site over the objections of the Israelis. And Richard Haass, a former senior State Department official under G.W. Bush, had a pretty good line. "Trump foreign policy has found its theme, the withdrawal doctrine," adding that its slogan should be "leaving from behind." So the real provocation here is that UNESCO recognizes the Palestinian people as a nation. And that's what really aggravates Israel, and they've gotten the United States once again to take actions that are in the interests of the Zionist government of Israel, but not the people of the United States. So Trump went to Middletown, Pennsylvania yesterday, staged an event in a hangar with a bunch of truck drivers and a couple of big rigs, and he's selling his tax cut package as rocket fuel for our economy. He said a cut to business taxes will help truckers because there'll be more products to deliver, more contracts to fill. "So many people have come up to me and said, give it to the middle class." Well, he sure is. And the way I'd characterize this is that he's promising that the tax cuts will trickle down to average people just like a golden shower. Sorry for that. Joe Arpaio's pardon has been partially upheld by the judge who found him in contempt of court. I do recognize that the presidential pardon power is generally considered to be unlimited, but there remain issues that will be litigated, and I support those efforts to overturn the pardon, if at all possible. That's about all I have time for today on the Peter B. Collins News and Comment podcast. I want to thank you for listening and invite you to share this podcast far and wide. We distribute it free every day, and it's also posted on YouTube.
happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.